Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode. Hi, and welcome to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. And I am your host, Brittany, and I am so stoked to share this conversation with you. This week, I spoke with Ashley Cossey Golden. Ashley is a pro-Black early childhood educator and homeschooling enthusiast. She is known as the creator of Afrocentric Montessori and the co-founder of Garden Forest School. Having started her journey in teaching at age 18, Ashley recalls a pivotal moment as a freshman at Oglethorpe University, where a student influenced her decision to shift her major from theater and communications to elementary and special education. Over her 14-year career, she has navigated various learning environments from traditional spaces such as public or charter schools, as well as progressive models like Reggio Emilia and Montessori in African-centered educational settings. The work Ashley engages in with Afrocentric Montessori and Gather is deeply rooted in passion and commitment. Serving as a labor of love and an educational haven for her two children, it is designed to ensure their Blackness is celebrated and their spirits remain intact. My conversation with Ashley did just that. It felt so incredibly affirming and just heartwarming to really speak with her about her background and really just how our backgrounds as Black women really intersected, and really talking about what that looks like and why it's so important to affirm, you know, our cultures and affirm, you know, children's cultures in the classroom, and what that can look like and what that can do. It was just really an amazing conversation that I'm so excited to share with you. So let's hop into it. Hi, and welcome to Conscious Pathways. Today I'm joined by Ashley. I'm so honored to have you on with me.
Thank you for the invitation. So happy to get into it with you.
I'm so excited to have you on. I know I follow your Instagram, and I just love the content that you're creating, especially around Montessori and specifically around Afrocentric Montessori. So I know we're going to dive in that and just really talk about it, because I think that's super fascinating. I also have a background in early childhood, but I did more Reggio. So I haven't actually had a lot of personal experience with Montessori, but I have a lot of respect for the Montessori practice. So I'm excited to hear more about it.
Oh, yes. And I started into the education in the Reggio space. Oh, wow. So that is also a beautiful philosophy that is liberating to the children. And of course, we're centering in Black children. So liberating to all children, but really good for Black kids to explore.
Snaps on that. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, my first question is always, if you could tell me a little bit about how you got your start in education, or who or what inspired you to join the field of education.
Yes. So I made my way to education through volunteering. So originally, I was a communication and theater major in undergrad, and I was volunteering at a charter school just because I always did volunteering all the way through middle school, high school, and so I continued that path in college for my undergrad. And it was, I don't know what it was, to be honest. Like, I just enjoy being around children. I enjoyed volunteering. I saw how the teachers were overwhelmed in the sense of just there was a lot of kids. There was a lot of things to do because I was volunteering at a charter school, but still traditional style education. Mm-hmm. And I saw children really falling in between the cracks just simply because the teacher had 20 plus other kids to make sure they were clicking on the right button. They were walking in a line. Mm-hmm. And the young of me, you know, was like, oh, there's a right and a wrong way to teach, right? Oh, she should be centering all her students. She should be personalizing. She should, baby. When I got into my student teaching, and I was in the classroom, I said, oh, oh, like,
it's harder than it looks.
When it's one, you have close to 30 children. We're talking about early childhood. So it is about classroom management. It is sit down. And I need you to sit down before I can move to the next one. No, I would love to hear your story you told me for the 15th time, but I need you to sit down. So, but younger version of me was like, all I could see was like, these children need this, and I'm gonna go into education and change education. And that's the beauty of youth. I will say that that is the beauty of being young and being like, I change the world. And so that's how I literally actually transferred colleges. I was like, I want to be a teacher. And so the college I was at did not have an education major or education minor. So I'm like, I transferred colleges. I end up going to Winthrop University and to their College of Education. I had to do an additional year of undergrad. And I came out, was like, guns blazing, ready to change. And I learned so much about education by actually doing education. I think there's a beauty in being in the ivory tower in college classes and talking about theory and having these beautiful dreams. But then there's also a really, I guess you could cut your teeth on it, place of actually doing the work. And I've been in different spaces. So I have been in charter. I have been in public school. I have done private school. I have done micro school. I actually run a micro school now. And I currently do homeschooling pods. And I've also been in Montessori and Reggio Emilia spaces and African centered spaces too. So I've actually been in many different educational spaces. And I will say one thing that rings true in all of them is that the children run the gamut of the same about connection is extremely important. Children want to be seen and they do enjoy learning. Like they do enjoy hanging out with their friends. They want to learn something new. They want to have fun and they want to be seen by you. And it doesn't matter if you have six kids in a nice little pod that I have in my home or when I was teaching with 28 kids. Each child wants to be seen by you. That was a long way around of how I got started.
And I love that. And sometimes it is just like this innate calling that's just like, you know what? This just feels right. I'm gonna do this and to see what happens. And I love that you got to experiment with a bunch of different, philosophies and charters and public and really get to get a feel of what type of education works best for you. I was talking to my other guest, Amanda. She was kind of saying that same thing where it's like, sometimes you're working in a space and it just doesn't align with the way that you want to teach. Yes, I've been there too. And it's just like, this doesn't feel, I've been in like spaces where it's very academically rigid. And I was like, this doesn't seem right. This isn't aligning with my soul. Like, I don't feel like this is developmentally appropriate. I don't feel like our practices are all right. And that if it's not feeling in alignment with you and your soul, like it's okay. There's probably just a different philosophy that'll work best for you.
Yes, and I have been in a situation with that, and I did not last
Oh,
long in
no.
that school.
Same.
I looked at it. I was gone by after Christmas break, so I didn't last very long. But I will say, being in situations or education spaces that are not aligned to how you flow or how you see education was also extremely eye-opening for me because I did come more progressive education, liberal way of thinking, and this was very much more traditionalized, very academic, like rigor. But what made me, why I needed to be there and see that was how the parents trusted the system. So I could say whatever I want, but when we think about parents who love their children, just like I love my children. And I can say that majority of people love their kids and they want what's best for their kids. When I saw parents trusted the system and they really did love the school, I said, well, who am I? This doesn't align to me, but it aligns to a lot of other children and their parents, and it works for them. And so that made me really change how I speak about education, especially educational philosophies that I wouldn't teach at or I wouldn't send my children to, but I don't have anything negative to say about it. And before I was like,
I been there. Or those early teaching days where you're just like, I know best and I
girl.
know everything. And then you get very quickly humbled. Been there. I feel that. But so you mentioned that you've done micro schools and you're currently running micro schools. And I know that there's been a lot of, information coming out in the news about micro schools, especially here in California. It's been a lot of talk of the town. We're talking a lot about micro schools lately. Do you want to kind of explain a little bit more about like what are micro schools and like kind of what their purpose is?
Yes, and I'll talk from more of, I guess, my lived experience of like the micro school. So I co-founded a micro school with Shelby Stone Still, and it's called Gather Forest School. And we are, our micro school is literally like a small school that is ran by, Shelby and I are certified teachers, but there are individuals, you do not have to be a certified teacher to run a micro school. But what's beautiful about it, we have small class sizes. So it's really like 6 to 7 students to an educator. You have a nice relationship with parents because we are, yes, I'm the lead teacher, but I'm also doing curriculum. I'm also like co-principal. I'm also doing the books of the school. So it is a lot of blending where when I was a teacher, all I was doing was teaching. I didn't have to worry about a mission. I didn't have to do bookkeeping. But in a micro school setting, unless you hire folks to fill those roles, but typically it is like you're wearing many hats. But I will say what's so great about that, is that you really become immersed within the process of education. Like, I really think micro schools is a way to reimagine education because you are going from a position where you were extremely siloed. Because teachers are, I will say, when I was in the classroom in a traditional sense, it is very siloing. Like, I had my students, I had my co-teacher, and that was it. I taught my class. In a micro school, we have students. I bring my children with me. So my youngest one is turning one, and we have children all the way to 10. So imagine a 1-year-old all the way to a 10-year-old. So we do have mixed ages, and it just widens. Like, I went from this to more of a this way. I'm trying to expand in terms of how I'm moving and seeing education, and children are bringing their full selves, because now I'm, even though I'm teaching all the subjects in early childhood, that's not new to us to do a diverse array of subjects. But it's almost hard to explain till you do it. Like, it is such a it's work, but it's fulfilling work, especially if you love your profession. If you love education, you will find it extremely fulfilling to run a micro school. And I also will say that the pay is extremely better than working in the school system.
I love to hear that. We all know, as educators, we don't get paid amazing. So.
Oh, in early childhood,
Oof.
it's. I know that's a whole conversation for another day, but it is, especially when they're requiring for some in traditional school spaces for early childhood educators to have a master's. It's like, how will you ever get your money back? Honestly speaking, like,
Because it's so much to get a master's degree, and then you get it, and then it's like, okay, well, I need to, pay this off now. You know, I had to get loans to pay this off now. And it's like, well, my salary doesn't make it so that I can pay this off in any sort of timely manner. So make it make sense.
Make it make sense, especially when early childhood educators are also mothers mm-hmm. and fathers. Like, so now you have to figure where am I going to put my child mm-hmm. while I'm teaching someone else's children. Yeah. So it is, when I say microschools is literally the future of education, not only for children, but also for the educators to be able to create or reimagine a life where you have enough.
Yes. You said so much in that sentence alone. Yes, yes, yes. I love the idea of microschools just reimagining. And I know, you know, we've been talking about that in California a lot, like the kind of emergence of these microschools and kind of what this means and what that looks like. And as you mentioned, it really does provide opportunities to look at school from a different type of lens, or take your school outside, or look at a different philosophy that within traditional education, you just don't really have the possibility to do that, right? You don't have the wiggle room to do that. Like, you have a curriculum that is handed to you, and you have standards, and you have all of these different, you know, competing things that you have to look at and do, which it kind of, one, it sucks the joy out of teaching. And two, with having such big class sizes, right? We're already in a teacher shortage. You know, the class sizes, they're only going to keep getting bigger and bigger, and the resources are they keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Yeah. And so unless you're working at like an incredibly well-funded school, which most of us don't, right? It gets rough, right? The students don't have everything they need to thrive and succeed. The families don't have everything they need to thrive and succeed. So you're just kind of contributing to a system that is already a little bit broken. And that can be really disheartening, and that can be, you know, really just morally hard to work through and to do, right? I think that's why we do see so many educators leaving the field. It's this disheartening kind of feeling. It's despair, right? Like, you just kind of get in the state of despair, and it's so hard to imagine what life would look like outside of that. But as, you know, you kind of also alluded to, like, in the beginning, when we go to school to learn education and we get super excited about it, especially early childhood, we get excited, we're thrilled, we have all these beautiful ideas and how we're going to get in that and how we're going to work in it. And it just so quickly, you get just disillusioned.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, so fast. And I get, and I know there's some folks who are listening and they're like, well, children can, and I'm, folks who are listening, like, thinking about the science of reading. Yes. And when you think about these things, like, well, we need to have standards. Mm-hmm. We need to have rigor. So then students are not falling through the gap. And this is definitely like a yes and conversation. Yes. Because, like, I like to remind people, even with the science of reading, oral language is extremely important. Mm-hmm. Oral language can come through songs, mm-hmm. telling stories. We can do letter sound, yes. but it can also still be culturally relevant. Yes. And these things are not happening in the classroom mm-hmm. when you're under pressure, when I got to give you worksheets and I have to do centers mm-hmm. and I have, like, it just doesn't work. Yeah. Like, the amount of creative energy you need to sit and tell a story, like, mm-hmm. think about the calming energy of that, to tell mm-hmm. a story, to have an emergent curriculum where it is coming from where you see students are engaging in, mm-hmm. that's hard to create when you're under such other pressures, external mm-hmm. pressures. And you do need to be in a space where leadership, because this is a top-down, mm-hmm. where leadership can see and be like, oh, I see where you're going with that. Yes. And it might take a little bit more time to get students engaged, to have quote-unquote mm-hmm. testing scores. You need to have a team. Yes. Like, this can't happen in a bubble. Because, yes, you're right. When we get our degrees, yeah. we're like, yeah. And then we get into schools where there might be a non-alignment with leadership yeah. or with your co-teacher or even the school in general. And you're like, oh, these ideas need to be put on the back burner because there's another agenda at play.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ugh. Yes, there's another agenda. But in the system, like you said, the system is broken. And I do believe the only way that we can fix it is reimagining it.
Yes.
because I'm also a believer that there are people who are gifted in teaching. Mm-hmm. Like there are people who are made,
yeah,
and was born to be teachers, and they should stay teachers. Mm-hmm. But like, we need to rethink of what does that look like on a grassroots,
yes,
community level, yeah, where we know that families have to work. Mm-hmm. We know children need to go somewhere when both parents have to work or when one parent has to work. Mm-hmm. Like, we know these are our realities. Yes. So we're both not wearing rose-colored, yeah, glasses, yeah, right? We know these things. But, like, how can we think about, and that's where micro schools come into, mm-hmm, play. Like, how can we restructure schooling where those who really want to teach and who are gifted to teach,
mm-hmm,
can stay in front of kids and families can get what they need while also having to work, having to pay bills, mm-hmm, and all those other things that requires by living in America, yeah, living in a capitalistic society.
Yep. That's immediately where my head went. Yeah, that's capitalism for us. Yeah. Just surviving capitalism. But you're so right. It's a yes and. Absolutely. It's a very strong yes and. So yes, we do want to make sure that we have standards. We want to make sure that we are,
yes,
providing high quality education,
yes,
for the students, for all students, because that's what they need and deserve, right? And so we know the great benefits of high quality care. And I think we are in a space where we're actively defining what high quality care looks like. But we need to look at that from a culturally responsive lens as well, right? So, you know, we have the quality rating and improvement system in the United States. And so that kind of looks at early childhood education from a national standard and kind of state by state, you know, states also as per, you know, usual in the US, but the states kind of have their own way of approaching quality within their state. But the purpose, right, is to have kind of a national standard or really looking at, you know, how are we improving quality nationally? And so a lot of that means that we're looking at, you know, things that are very like kind of data driven, which is important. We do need data to kind of help influence,
yeah,
you know, what we do policy wise, and the data is really important, right? But also, again, looking at how are we also making sure that this is culturally responsive? Because usually with the quality rating improvement systems, you're looking at, you know, things like your Eckers or your environmental rating scales. You're looking at, you know, the class testing, which is your classroom assessment and scoring, yeah, system. And so these are, you know, assessment systems that have been, you know, researched and validated, which again, great. We do need things that are research-backed and validated, but have been historically, yeah, haven't been as culturally responsive in terms of assessments, right? And so that means, you know, are we looking at quality from, you know, just purely a data sense? Or are we looking at quality from how does it also center the cultural needs, the language needs? You know, was it really centering the community needs within that school system, right? So those are also just as important aspects as what we're looking at, you know, from interactions, and we're looking at from that assessment, like those are important, but it's also important that, you know, children are affirmed and validated in their culture, in their language, in their belonging, right? Those things are also, yes, really important.
It's vital. Mm-hmm. It's vital, yes, especially at this age, this young age where children are making meaning, mm-hmm, and making sense.
Yes.
And they're bringing their full selves into the classroom. Yes. And children are extremely astute to understand, mm-hmm, where it's like, okay, this works here, but it doesn't work there. Mm-hmm. And especially for Black students, Black students are very fast. Like, all right, this, what happens in school is, mm-hmm, considered right.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I learn and speak and move at home, mm-hmm, has to be different. And we know, like, that is totally not true. And I won't fall down the rabbit hole when it comes to what is shamed in education, mm, about Blackness,
yes,
is dollar signs outside of education, mm, because our culture is constantly being copied and replicated, mm, for the highest dollar. But within classroom or education space it is deemed
mm,
to be incorrect.
Yep.
So we do need a way of validating these experience of children of the global majority,
yes,
because outside of the classroom, mm-hmm, folks are buying it up. Folks are bottling it up and paying top dollar for the same cultures that we are getting scrubbed out of the classroom for.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. Like, you know what? Let's just open that can of worms. Let's let the worms free now, because that is so true. You know, a lot of Black culture has been, you know, commodified outside of the culture, right? So, you know, you're looking at the BBLs and you're looking at, you know, the long nails and the hair and all the different things that have kind of been appropriated from Black culture, and now is in the space where it's getting monetized and people are gaining money from it. And so now it's, you know, looked and deemed as this, like, you know, positive, like, new thing that just came out, when, you know, Black people have been doing it for decades, right?
Yeah.
And been shamed for it, been shamed for the way that we talked, been shamed for the way that our hair grows out of our head, been shamed for the way that we dress, the neighborhoods that we come from, the food that we eat, right? And so, you know, and that happens as a part in the classroom. It happens, you know, as part of our society, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's ingrained into the our society in terms of how we, our ideologies, so how we see people, how we, you know, interact with people, and then it goes, you know, into our institutions, and then it goes into, like, how we're interacting with people, right? And so there's all these different, like, lenses and filters that basically it's going through, like, oppression essentially is kind of filtering its way through. And, you know, part of that is through education. And so what do we deem as kind of appropriate or inappropriate, especially when it comes to language? That's a really, really big one. How, you know,
yeah,
just immediately being shamed for your language, where we know and we've seen studies, we've seen the data, and we've seen, like, the positive impact when we actually affirm people and their manner of speech, and just kind of understanding that that's a part of culture, right? So we could still teach, you know, English and language and literacy, but we can also do that in a way that still affirms people's culture and doesn't shame their culture, doesn't shame where they come from. Because I don't know about you, but I've never really learned anything positive through shame.
No, it almost becomes a, because I learned how to code switch at a very young age. I think most children from the global majority learn that real quick, unless you end up not caring. But I did have parents who were extremely strict about grades, about how one carries oneself. So I had to learn very quick the way that I operate at home or with my friends was something that does not belong in academic and educational spaces. And unfortunately, our children have to learn that quick if they want to be seen as individuals to get recommended for the internships, for the scholarship, for colleges. Like, it, unfortunately, it, because of how the society we have set up, those things matter. Because when you, and then there's have been studies, and I've also been in many conversations when these things come up, it was like, oh, I didn't even see race, or I didn't even see color. I just felt really comfortable with XYZ, and notice XYZ is white.
Yeah.
You felt more comfortable with the individuals who align to your likes, who look like you. And I had to learn at a very young age to be even considered for things. I also had to assimilate to the dominant culture. So when you were thinking about things, you would say, like, oh, you would consider Ashley in that. And unfortunately, Ashley had to have the mannerisms of a white girl. So when you were thinking about, my name was also included with the names you were envisioning for white girls. And if we really, in a lot of conversations when we talk about with Black folks or other adults from the global majority, our stories will be very similar. When you think about, like, oh, well, how did you get to college? How did you get that prestigious scholarship or internship? Our stories will sound very similar of how we got that recommendation. It was not because we were our full bold, so I can say that much.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, I feel you. Growing up, I also have, you know, I've been told this very white sounding name. I've heard this from teachers. I've heard this from peers, or they're like, oh, you talk like a white girl. And it's like, okay. Like, come on now. And so constantly having these things, one, you know, trained out of you is like, if you want to be successful, then you have to pretty much leave mm-hmm. all of like the quote unquote dirty parts of your culture behind so that you can assimilate and then you can be successful. And the negative impact on that is that, you know, I always say this in my trainings, but like, I will never not be a Black woman. Like, you know, I'm not going to wake up one day and just not have this brown skin. It will very likely be brown skin, right? And so I carry that with me everywhere I go. I don't just shed that off and then just, you know, walk through the world however I feel like. Like, that's not the case. You know, I'm always going to be looked at and perceived as a Black woman because that is what I am and that's what I look like, right? And in a lot of ways in education, it gets stifled out in terms of exactly what you're saying. If you want to, you know, get the honors classes, if you want to get the mm-hmm. internships, if you want to get the recommendations, right, mm-hmm. you're going to have to assimilate. You're going to have to kind of be outside of who you want to be, right, or who you yes. are, and seeing, you know, and so the detrimental impact is that I'm not seeing the value of my culture out at school. I'm not seeing it in the community. I'm not mm-hmm. seeing it online. I'm not, you know, and we're getting better at being more representative, especially in media and movies and stuff like that. Like it's getting better. It's moving in a direction, but you know, when we were younger, that just wasn't always really the case. And it does have a negative impact. And it took me going to college, and I went to a primarily Hispanic serving institution, and that's where I had professors that looked like me. That's where I had, yeah. you know, I looked around and everyone else in the classroom, like we're all brown people. And the conversations that we had was just different because we could all show up as ourselves and have these deeper conversations. And we weren't kind of tiptoeing around different topics because it was like, no, let's talk about oppression right here, right now. Like, what does that look like? And we're mm-hmm. all sharing our experiences. And it wasn't until that moment that I started to really like break down a lot of that internalized stuff yes. that you learn, you know, all throughout your formative years of life, right? You learn all of these things about your culture and, you know, what's okay and what's not okay. And even in invisibility speaks volumes, right? you know, so we learn a lot by what's visible. And especially as children, we learn a lot by who's not visible, who's not in the room, whose voices aren't being heard, you know, especially in our books, yeah. our toys, our resources. Like we learn a lot by who's not there. Right.
Yeah.
Oh God. But yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Like I had to do the same journey as an adult. Mm-hmm. I actually had to take a whole entire break from whiteness because mm-hmm. it was such a traumatic experience for me where I just like literally had my fill and I had to go into all whites, all Black spaces mm-hmm. To heal. And that was actually the first time I was in an all Black space. I was 23 or just turned 24. And so that was eye opening. I found out I had huge amount of anti-Blackness living in my body that I had to work through. And it was something that was painful, but so necessary to like really confront the way whiteness was showing up in my body, the way I actually needed white validation, like to the upteenth degree. Like I actually needed someone white to tell me that I was doing a good job teaching or to check my work and say like, oh, you're such a strong educator. Because mind you, I've been getting that feedback since I started preschool. Mm-hmm. And so reaching a point after my graduate studies where I had to take a hard break from whiteness and really like detox was extremely painful and sitting with all the hurt that came up. But I will say Audre Lorde's book, Sister Outsider,
yes,
like gave me the language.
Yes. I love that book. It's right over there. I love that book.
It allowed me to rage. It allowed me to cry. It allowed me to figure out what the hell was going on. Because I just felt so lost and just so confused and sad and angry. Like, I felt all of these things. And, like, the deepest part of me felt just, like, hurt. Like, I spent all these years doing all these amazing things, trying to get accepted, jumping through all the hoops, making sure I got A's and everything, showed up on time, stayed late, like dedicated. Mm-hmm. And still, in the eyes, I was still a Black girl. Mm-hmm. I was still unprofessional. When I made the smallest mistake, yeah. I'm being unprofessional. Like, everything that I did prior did not matter. Mm-hmm. And so going through that process was necessary, but it also makes me, it was necessary, again, for the story, for mm-hmm. me to realize when I talk to parents how important it is for your child to be in affirming spaces, mm-hmm. for your child to be in spaces where they're seen, where they're recognized, mm-hmm. but also spaces where truth-telling happens, because mm-hmm. your child needs to have the language,
yes.
to understand what is happening, mm-hmm. to understand that it is not their Black skin, it is not them that these things are happening. This mm-hmm. is a system, a structure, these are laws, mm-hmm. and let's give them the blueprint on how to navigate that, mm-hmm. but to pretend it doesn't exist, mm-hmm. to tell the lies of just study harder, baby, just, you know, just find next, mm-hmm. is really setting your children up for success. And I am a byproduct of being valedictorian of my class, being able to go to Columbia University Teachers College mm-hmm. on a scholarship. Like, I am the product of one who's like, all I gotta do is just work harder. All I have to do is just study. Yeah. All I have to do is make the right connections. Yeah. And my parents did not give me the language mm-hmm. of, there's other things at play, baby.
Yeah.
Like, of course, operate in your gifts. I'm not telling anybody not to operate in their gifts. I'm not telling anybody not to do your mm-hmm. best. But we also have to have that crucial conversation of there's other things at play. And when you hit the wall multiple times, baby, it ain't you.
Yeah.
And sometimes you got to get up from that table. Like Nina Simone said, when love ain't being served, mm-hmm. get up from that table.
Ooh.
And I did not know that. Like, mm-hmm. I had to literally become completely undone by whiteness and have to go on my own self-journey healing, because I should have got up from that table decades ago.
Yeah.
Where I should have realized, I'm like, you know, I'm doing literally the best I can, and I'm still getting fed crumbs. Mm-hmm. Love ain't here. I actually got to go take this love and do something else with mm-hmm. it for my community.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're so focused, and there's nothing wrong. Again, going back to that, this is an and conversation.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wanting your children to excel to the highest level yeah. capable. Like, nothing wrong with yeah. that. But we also have to be really honest with our children and with ourselves about the world we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, you know, I'm going back to just my early learning, and like, I'm connecting with it just so deeply, because I agree. I was also, you know, a person who, I worked hard. I got pretty decent grades. I moved around a lot. So there was a lot going on there. But, you know, I got really great grades. I was in, you know, I got accepted into the IB program at school and all those different things. And so it was like, I always pride, especially when I started going to college, I prided myself on like, I study hard. I work hard to get to what I yes. need. 'Cause that's what you're told. You know, you're told if you do hard work and you study hard and you do everything you have to do and you stay on track and you stay in the right, you know, you don't get mixed up in anything you shouldn't be getting mixed up into, like, you're going to succeed. And you're going to be successful. Okay. Right. And, you know, I believed that. I was like, yeah, totally. And then, you know, I got into the working field, and I started, you know, working. And I remember I had this HR guy once tell me, he was like, well, you know, us as Black people, like, we have to work 10 times harder than anyone else in this room in order to, you know, get through and get by. And like, I remember like just going on my lunch break and just like, I couldn't explain why I felt the way I did in that moment. And, you know, when I reflect back on that, I'm like, well, yeah, it was, you know, it was the beginning of that very like intense moral injury where it was like, it doesn't matter how many degrees I get. It doesn't matter no. how many letters I get after my name. It doesn't matter no. that I show up to work on time, you know, before, you know, the before I'm supposed to be there every day. It doesn't matter if I go above and beyond. At the end of the day, I'm still going to be perceived the way that I am, right? And the perception of that. And so that really hit me kind of hard when I was younger, because I was like, you just had that in your mind that, like, well, of course, like, you know, society and the ideologies and everything tells you that, like, well, yeah, you know, they are, you know, like, all these bad things are happening to brown people because it's their own fault. Like, they did it. Like, they're the ones, they're committing a lot of crime. So it's like, that's why that's happening. But, like, if you try hard enough, like, that won't happen to you. And so you have that in your head of, like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, I'm going to be a perfect little angel, and then these bad things won't happen to me. I won't be a product of racism and oppression. Like, I'm doing what you told me I was supposed to do. And then when you still get slapped in the face with racism, you're like, but I did all the things. And so I did all the things, like, I did what I was supposed to do. And so, like, that's what so many of, like, then that's what we're talking about. It's a yes and conversation. Exactly what you said is that, yes, we agree that education is important. Yes, we agree that standards are important. And we've got to also understand that affirming people's culture and the way that they exist is also incredibly important, right? Because, you know, you can do all these academic things, and at the end of the day, racism still is going to exist. The system is still going to be against you, and it's not fair and it's not right, but we do children a disservice by not doing anything about that, by not acknowledging it, because we can't just pretend it's not there and then it goes away, because that clearly hasn't been working. Hasn't been working for years, right? That's not the method. And when we actually acknowledge it, and we give, like you said, we give students the tools, we give students the language, right? We give students the understanding. And I get a lot of questions, you know, about, you know, oh, well, we have a mostly, you know, white school, so we don't need to really focus on culturally responsive, sustaining, relevant pedagogy, because they're all white kids, right? Like, we only need to do that for the brown kids. And it's like, well, no, who do you think is going to go on and keep perpetuating these things, right? It's important that we all are understand. That's why it's so important. Critical race theory, like, it's important that we know the history, we know the language, we know what's happening and how we got here and why we're here, so that we can build a future that is the way that we imagine it to be. That is the way that we think it is today. We think it's, oh, it's colorblind, or we think, you know, oh, we've reached this point, like, you know, as long as we just, like, don't keep talking about race and racism, like, then that's the reason why it's still a problem. It's like, no, that's not how that works.
Because humans will find something else to create. Mm-hmm. Just like racism, social construct, they will literally find something else to differentiate, to separate, to exclude, and to include. Yes. So if it's not, then it's height. Mm-hmm. If it's not height, then it's their length or hair color, like, or eye color. It will always be
something else. And I think we see that. It happens, you know, people, you know, find religion, or they'll find gender, or they find sexuality. It's like, there's always going to be something, right, that we're going to categorize people by and say, like, well, I'm better than because I am this. When it's just like, that shouldn't be the way it is.
And that's another tenet of why it's so important. Mm-hmm. Like, we were talking about sharing the blueprint, talking about the history, because then you start finding commonality of how can we band together.
Yes.
Then you start thinking about, you'll literally start thinking in system ways of, like, okay, so what caused this? Wait, this law caused this? Why? Well, who was at the table when these laws were being made? And again, these are higher order thinking. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about 3 and 4 year olds, but when you start this conversation at 3 and 4 about talking about the importance of how we all have a place on this earth, how is we all are valid, you start using these languages. That when we start studying history, start studying laws, now we're going to get more into the nuances.
Now you're ready.
Of how laws were set up to discriminate, to exclude. Who was at these tables? Who were having these conversations? Who was left out? But then you're really starting to, children are now connecting the dots. And now we could really start talking about reimagining something.
Yeah.
Right? Because now the children are actually standing on something solid. and not just reimagining in an abstract way without understanding what has already been built. Mm-hmm. And so we got to understand what has been built so we can destruct it.
Exactly.
So we can really tear it apart, examine. And I'm also, I come from the thought of we don't need to toss everything out. Mm. There's some things that need to be re-looked at. There's some things that need to be tweaked. Mm-hmm. There's some things that need to be stressed and pulled apart and said, like, well, what is the broken piece here? Yes. What could be replaced here? And there are some parts that actually need to be snipped out mm-hmm. and thrown. But, like, we can't have any of this if we're not getting into the weeds of it. Mm-hmm. If we're not starting in early childhood. Yeah. That all voices are valid, mm-hmm. not just white heterosexual male voices.
Yes.
Like, we need to have those very explicit conversations, mm-hmm. lessons, books, songs, yeah. video, like all the things. Mm-hmm. Because, like you said, children are very aware of who's not in
the room. Yeah. They're painfully aware of this, you know? And I think sometimes we get in this conversation and I think people think that it's about taking away or that it's about, you know, devaluing other people, especially like, you know, if we're talking about whiteness and we're talking about white supremacy and we're talking about systems of oppression and the impact of these things, I think sometimes the mind goes automatically to, well, that means you're trying to take white people out of schools or you're trying to make white people feel bad about, you know, racism and put all the blame. And it's just like, actually, like if you're listening to the core of what it is, it's about elevating all the voices. It's about ensuring that everyone has a voice at the table, not just one person, right? That everyone is valued and important. And that includes white people as well. It's not saying that we don't want white people to exist. It's saying that we want to evaluate these systems that primarily are benefiting one group while other people are being actively oppressed by it. And it's about making sure that, you know, the goal of, you know, restorative justice and social justice really is to make sure that people are treated with dignity, that their humanity is respected, right? That they are valued, that they are affirmed, that applies to everybody, not just one body, to everybody. That is the ultimate goal. We want everybody to feel affirmed, everybody to feel like they are valued, that they have something that they can add to our society and our world, right?
We need everybody. Mm-hmm. We need everybody. Yeah. And if you are hearing this and all you hear is that white people should be punished or we mm-hmm. and or white people should feel bad or guilty, mm-hmm. that is projection. That is something that's that inner work. That's the inner work that no one can do for you.
Yes.
Because we need everybody. Mm-hmm. When I talked about having gifts, we all have gifts. Yes. We all have something to give to this world, mm-hmm. regardless of religion, race, mm-hmm. all of it. Like, we all have a gift. Mm-hmm. But now we're talking about how can we show up in our gift and our fullness, because as society stands, mm-hmm. it's not an equal, we don't have an equal space mm-hmm. to live in our full gifts. We have to, especially those who are mm-hmm. part of the global majority, we have to do so much letting go, cutting things off, figuring out the hidden curriculum, mm-hmm. figuring out things that are not being said. Like, it's such a gymnastics to get to a place where we can live in our fullness when it doesn't have to be that way. That's how it is. Yeah. But what I'm saying, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
So if you are hearing this conversation or you've heard conversations similar and the first thing that comes up is that you should feel guilty or shame mm-hmm. of the history, what things are going on. That just means you got some work to do.
Yeah.
Because guilt serves no one. Guilt don't help mm-hmm. me. Baby, you feeling guilty don't help me none. It doesn't.
It absolutely doesn't. Like I said, nobody learns through guilt and shame. Like, that's not how we learn. That's not how we grow.
They don't have,
like, that's not the maybe. Purpose.
That's not the purpose. No. Close that door. Do that work. Yeah. Cry to yourself. Mm-hmm. Have to, but do that work so then you could come out of that closet mm-hmm. and get to work.
Yeah, because like
that's what we are saying.
That's all we're saying.
Like we, everybody's health.
Yeah.
Everybody benefits.
Everybody benefits. And just like other people are probably also tired about hearing about race all the time, I'm tired of talking about it all the time. I don't want to talk about this. I'm pretty sure there is better ways that I could be spending my time. I don't want to be talking about this all the time, but like the necessity is there, right? It's, you know, harming children, it's harming our students, it's halting their growth and their success, right? And so it's a conversation that we need to keep having, you know, and it's exactly. out of necessity. But I can assure you, if I didn't have to, I would not. I have so many other entertaining things that I could be talking about, that I could be elevating, right? And so just as you are probably tired of hearing people bring everything to race, talking about race all the time, we're tired of talking about it. We don't want to do this.
We don't. I don't want to have to prove that my humanity matters, mm-hmm. that the humanity of the children I teach matters. Mm-hmm. But because it's like you're in a vacuum. Yeah. Because it is not seen mm-hmm. or represented or thought about. I am going to keep bringing that. I'm going to keep bringing it up mm-hmm. in every room and every conversation yeah. to make sure that my students, my children, my community mm-hmm. is and heard and validated yes. in these spaces.
Yes. And on this topic, so... You know, a lot of what your content is talking about is kind of Afrocentricism, right? And especially in education and in Montessori. And so I feel like that is essentially what we're talking about and what we're alluding to. So do you want to like kind of describe a little bit about what that is and how you're doing that in your school?
Yes. I tell folks about Afrocentric way of being mm-hmm. and if it could be in your classroom, like education, or it could be how you live your life, mm-hmm. it's really putting the humanity of Black people in everything that you do. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very humanic way of thinking of, like, how are we seeing our Blackness? Mm-hmm. How are we connecting to the diaspora? Because mm-hmm. Black is such a huge time. Mm-hmm. It's not a monolith. And you people who are listening probably heard that yeah. all the time. But it's really not, because if you, and even if you don't identify with Black culture, mm-hmm. you just have to go to any community, check out a book, mm-hmm. look at the documentary. You can see Blackness is not a monolith mm-hmm. and it's so expansive. Mm-hmm. So when I think about what I'm creating, especially in the Montessori context of materials, or things that I'm creating for the Forest School, Gather Forest mm-hmm. School, I'm always thinking about what are the different ways that Blackness can show up, mm-hmm. whether it's in food, whether we're talking about nature and we're thinking about the ancestors mm-hmm. who literally paved the way for many of the studies we have in the sciences. If I'm looking at the continent of Africa and going back into the history books of what minerals, what resources mm. that was pulled out of Africa. Because again, we are, our age group expands from early childhood to elementary age kids. So we are having those history lessons of how Africa got divvied up. Mm. Who was in the room? We're asking those questions. Yeah. Who was in the room when things happened? And again, it's not to bring shame. Mm. It's not to create the rhetoric of white people are bad or mm. white people did this, but it's really getting our kids' brains to think about, let's create something different. Yes. These are what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's why I talk about why Afrocentric education is so important mm-hmm. because we're having the conversations of literally what happened in the past, mm-hmm. not that whitewash history, what happened in the past. And it's hard things, but it's also beautiful things that our people did.
Yes.
I always tell folks, Black folks are truly alchemists. If you are Black, you are an alchemist. The way you're able to take literally scraps, mm. things that were thrown, mm-hmm. what other folks would call trash, how birth babies, mm-hmm. raised babies, created invention, built a nation off of scraps, off of being in pain. And I get very emotional when I talk about this because I feel like for Black folks, we are forgetting our truth. And sometimes we get caught up in all the hard things and wrong things that happen. Those are truth. But also our beauty and our strength, those are also true things. And so when we come from an Afrocentric perspective, we're bringing both things into the room. And we're having those conversations with the hopes that our children are creating and thinking about worlds to pave a way forward, to pave a true reality, a truer, a newer, a fuller truth in reality. For, of course, we center Blackness for Black folk, but when I say it's truly for everybody, I mean it because we need everybody in this future.
Yes, yes. And I love the way that you really broke that down, especially on kind of what Afrocentric is and, you know, talking about the history and talking about how far we've come, because there is so much joy and so much resilience in the things that we do. And it's important that we acknowledge that and we look at that. So yes, there was trauma. Yes, there was hardship. Yes, there was, you know, forced movement from, you know, the continent to other places. So yes, all these things happened, right? But all these beautiful things have come from it. And there's so much strength and resilience and all these different things, right? And, you know, bringing in our, you know, the Blackness and the culture into just the curriculum and asking those questions, because a lot of people will say, how can we have, you know, conversations about, you know, social justice, and how can we have conversations about, you know, oppression with young children? Like, that's just going to scare them, or that's just gonna, it's just gonna scar them. But it's like, no, actually, obviously, we're not talking about talking to them about graphic, horrific things to them at that, you know, really young age. But what we're doing is we're setting the stage for asking some questions. We're setting the stage for thinking about things in a different way, processing things in a different way, right? So maybe, you know, obviously our three-year-olds might not have a great grasp on what the word oppression means, right? But they do know about fairness. They do know what's fair and what's not fair. And they will tell you that. they might not know exactly what power is or what that word power means, but they have a good idea on, you know, fairness. They have a good idea on, you know, what's good and what's bad, right? So they have these ideas and concepts in mind. We just have to kind of introduce different ways of thinking and different ways of communicating that.
Yes. 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 Because they have the foundation. Like, they get it. Like, they get when they feel powerful, when they feel powerless. Like, children. And again, like you said, we're three-year-olds. We're not pinning white folks against Black folks or Black folks against. We're not pinning that. We are using what they feel and providing examples of, oh, wow, you felt powerless at that. Why? And like having these conversations. So when the child gets older, when we talk about as a child age, now we're able to like add more language. Now we're able to bring in more examples from a historical standpoint or examples within the child's community. And they're able to grow in their understanding. Because when we think about things that happen on a macro level, we also realize there's smaller ways that happen on a micro. So something in my personal relationship, sometimes I'm able to empathize or connect to like, oh, I kind of know how this person felt because this happened to me in this situation. That's all the inner work that you won't see on the test. That's the work that's not testable. That's not, you're not going to see that on the standard, really. That's the slow work that teachers do that can't be graded. That's sitting down hearing children speak and be like, I'm going to actually step into this conversation and sit and listen for a bit. And I'm going to help support this child through this conversation because there's things coming up that needs to be. And I can even go back from when I was a child. I was the only Black child within my preschool. And there were things when children at three saying horrible things about my Black skin. I remember looking at the teacher. I remember looking for a teacher to say me, to step in, to say, that's not nice. Say something. Yeah. And when I say crickets, or when things did come up because I was crying, don't say that. That's unkind.
Yeah.
And I know parents are putting their kids in the best situation, but I will reiterate, examine those spaces. Examine those spaces, because so much of that's not said is loud to the child.
Yeah.
Because I allowed that behavior to continue till I was in my 20s, till I actually got up from the table and said, yeah, I know, this ain't right. Because when I said adults speak wild and crazy in my face, and I just was like, I'm going to just get the grade. I'm just gonna and keep on moving when I didn't have to. And that's the thing. Like, I can't, like, say it enough that we got to give our Black children the language and the blueprint so they know how to navigate. We're making strategy moves, not a feeling of like, I can't leave because of this, where it's like, no, I'm gonna stay for this long because I'm going over here. Like, now I'm making decisions out of strategy, not because I'm scared, not because I'm afraid of retaliation, not because I don't think I'm good enough. No, baby, it's strategy. Yep. I'm here because I have something bigger over there. Like, that, we need our children to start thinking and moving, and not because they're not good enough or they have imposter syndrome. I gotta talk to you all day.
Yes. but on that topic, how do you reimagine education?
So for me, education would definitely be taken out of the hands of the state. So I really do see education on a extremely micro community level. When I say community, like on a town level, where there are different schools based on folks' need and their ability, but almost like a co-op style, like families are actually stepping in to support and teach. And you do have teachers who are also opening that door so parents can know what happens in the classroom, where it's a very collaborative. I know when we bring different people into something, there is a lot more work. So for me, a reimagined education is on a personal level, community level, where we are having town meetings or community meetings about what the children are learning, and being fully aware where we are going to disagree, but that disagreement is not going to break us. Like, that's what I really wish within education on a community level, that we don't allow disagreements to break us. Because too often we do let our differences and disagreements create fractures where, fine, I'll create my own group. And we do a splinter. That is not the reimagined education I'm talking about. I'm really talking about being able to forge ahead in disagreements and really understand where people are coming from and how can we make it better.
Yes. I love that. Working through our disagreements and working through our differences, right? It is in our differences that there's so much beauty, that there's so much joy, so much to be gained through just the ways that we did, different ways that we think about things. Like, there's beauty in our differences, and we shouldn't shy away from that.
No, we shouldn't. Like, I really would love parents to reclaim being their child's first teacher. Being able to really feel like what it means to be in a community, or that village mindset of, that's what a reimagined education will look like. It was like really going back to going back to the blueprint, yeah. going back to understanding, it does take a village to raise a child. Mm-hmm.
It does. It does. It takes a community and really coming back to the essence of community and what that looks like and what that feels like, and kind of moving away from this, you know, very individualistic, you know, thing that we've got going on. But really, you know, as humans, like, we know that we need people, we need community, we need, you know, yeah. we need these things in order for us to, you know, be successful and for us to thrive as a whole. So, you know, I love the idea of just coming back to that, that community and coming back to connection and what that looks like and what that means. Cause it's so important and so integral. And I agree, Ashley, I could just talk to you about this all day. So I want to thank you so much for joining me in conversation and sharing your experience and your knowledge and just all of this beauty. It was just such a wonderful conversation. Where can my audience find you? Where can they connect with you? Are you working on anything new?
Yes. So you can find me at on IG at afrocentric.montessori. Mm-hmm. And you can also find me for the Gather Forest School, IG at gather.school. Yeah. I'm active also on my webpage at www.afrocentricmontessori.com. Mm-hmm. And then for my Gather Forest School, we do have a website. If you just want to know mm-hmm. the general, like, what do we do at a forest school? Mm-hmm. It's www.gatherforestschool.com. Mm-hmm. And we also have a Mighty Networks that you can find on the website where we write articles, we share our experiences. Mm-hmm. So if you want a little bit more sauce, yay. Join our Mighty Networks community.
Very exciting. And I'll put that all in our show notes below. So if you want to check out any of those resources and you want to follow Ashley on any of those platforms, I'll leave that there. Again, thank you so much, Ashley, for just joining me and sharing and, you know, just being in community. I am just always loved the content and I love talking. I loved this conversation so much. It felt just like a warm embrace. So I really appreciate it.
But like, I was like, oh, it feels good to be able to look back to talk about it. Yes. Because when I was going through it, girl.
I feel that.
And now to like have a testimony to share mm-hmm. with other parents of like, let's really be critical and think yeah. about this and talk to other parents. It's a true blessing. So thank you for allowing me to share some of my thoughts.
I love it. Hopefully, you know, we'll have other ways of communicating and collaborating because I loved it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning into Conscious Pathways. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to Conscious Pathways wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to really leave a rating or a review. It really does help the podcast to grow and find more listeners just like you. And if you want to connect with Conscious Pathways, you can follow us on Instagram at conscious.pathways. You can also find me on YouTube at Conscious Pathways. And if you want to see more about what I talk about, you can see me on LinkedIn at just Brittany Carey. I also have a company page on there, Conscious Pathways. So if you're just wanting to keep in contact with what we're doing, if you want to support Conscious Pathways, I have a link down below where you can donate via our Ko-fi. That's K-O-F-I. So it's a way that you can donate and support the podcast. That helps me to find more that helps me to find more guests, that helps me to improve the reach of the podcast, help me to improve and research more topics for the podcast. If you're looking for additional ways to support Conscious Pathways, you can find me on Patreon at Conscious Pathways. That's also linked below. If you want to join there and subscribe, we'll have a newsletter available for subscribers and ability to ask questions that I can answer right here live on air. Or we can ask an expert. So any of our guests that I have on, we can ask a question via there. So that's just another way of supporting the podcast. Again, it helps me to find more guests. It helps me to do research for the podcast. We do a lot of work behind the scenes. It's a labor of love for sure. So if you're looking for ways to just support, you don't have to, just listening and being a part of the community, that supports me in a lot of ways as well. So just appreciating anyone who's supporting and listening and just being a part of the conscious community. And until next time, don't forget to navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations. Bye.